Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on Impeachment Day. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip. And our guest is Jonathan Allen, author and NBC political correspondent extraordinaire. Jonathan, welcome back to the podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here, General Sykes.
Well, you know what? I dug up an old story about you, which you were described as ambitious, curious, contrarian, and headstrong 9 years ago. Still true?
Most of those things are definitely still as true as they were then.
I mean, I think those, at least three of those, are really crucial to be a good reporter. Curious, contrarian, and headstrong.
Yeah, and ambition can get you in trouble.
Right.
But the rest of them are definitely good for reporting.
Okay, so let's talk about where we're at right now this morning, because this is a significant news day. The Brits are voting, and interestingly enough, AOC's decided that she's going to endorse Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. We'll just leave that aside because there'll be plenty of time to talk about British politics. And by the end of the day, the House Judiciary Committee, correct me if I'm wrong, will have voted to advance two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump to the floor of the House. That's going to happen today, right?
I'm trying to keep up with this cross-Atlantic talk here. Yeah. I thought we already impeached George III. I'm not sure. Yeah, no, you're right, Charlie. By the end of the day, there should be two articles of impeachment approved by the House Judiciary Committee and sent on toward the House floor.
So the headline in the Washington Post today is the Democrats are bracing for defections from moderates. What's the over-under on that?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. I think the important thing for the House Democrats, I believe the number is 18 that they can lose and still get a majority. There are 431 seats currently occupied, meaning four vacancies. You do all the math on that. They can lose 18, I think. I don't think they're going to lose 18. The numbers I've heard have been anywhere from about half a dozen to a dozen.
Mm.
But I think that dozen is a real high number. I think you're much more likely to see something in the low to mid single digits.
Okay, just remind me now when they had the first vote, they lost a few, but not that many, right?
They lost two. They lost two. Colin Peterson from Minnesota, who's got a district that I think favored Donald Trump by more than 30 points, and Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, whose district is slightly less pro-Trump, but still a district that is difficult for Van Drew to hold, and one that Van Drew would like to hold for a long time. So he's definitely willing to separate himself from Democratic leadership.
Okay, and the other jockeying that's going on now as people begin to focus on the Senate trial, Democrats have to decide who their floor managers are going to be.
That's right, and they basically all have one answer to the question of who should prosecute Donald Trump in the Senate, and that is pick me.
Mm-hmm.
Not me, Jonathan Allen, but for each of them.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some that want to hide in terms of, and frankly, some of the people who might be best to do that job are the ones that want to hide. I think listeners may remember that in the last election cycle, Democrats did a very good job of recruiting a couple of different types of candidate, namely veterans who were kind of moderates and former prosecutors who were kind of moderates, you know, both of whom had some, I think, credibility as being very serious. And in a couple of cases, former prosecutors who were also veterans, Connor Lamb from Western Pennsylvania, Mikey Sherrill from New Jersey. Those are the types of people the Democrats would like to put forward, except for the problem is they don't want to be in this sort of polarized partisan atmosphere elevated as the face of an impeachment that is kind of tearing the country apart right now.
Yeah.
Whether you're for impeachment or against impeachment, you can obviously see that it's very divisive.
Okay, so where are we at now on this question of how short the trial is going to be? You know, a lot of speculation now that Republicans have kind of moving toward a really short trial with no witnesses at all, kind of a quickie in-out sort of thing.
I heard Lindsey Graham talking on Fox News today. He said he wanted it to end in 1999. And, you know, if he could turn it back to yesterday and finish the trial, he would do it. He didn't actually say that. He said that He thought that it could be done in as close to a week as possible, meaning that it might take more than a week for the Democrats to present their evidence, but he believed there should be no witnesses.
And no essentially, witnesses.
Yeah, and essentially, you know, not much of a defense from the president because there's nothing to defend because there's no evidence to present. And he believes that anything regarding Joe Biden can be handled outside of impeachment. I don't know if that's a threat to prosecute Joe Biden, but sure sounded that way.
Okay, so I'll confess to being naive about how Senate trials are supposed to go, but how do you have a trial without any witnesses? What would it look like? What would it sound like?
You know, I think all of this is fairly unusual. I briefly attended the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton back in early 1999. I had a friend who got me a ticket for one of the public galleries because I was not yet a reporter. And, you know, it's going to not look that interesting.
Well, yeah, okay.
Look, if you're a junkie for this stuff, if you love public affairs, it is going to be the most interesting thing you've ever seen. But it is 100 senators sitting there silently. It is going to be the presentation of a legal case and not condensed into the, you know, law and order, half an hour for the law and half an hour for the order.
Okay, so how do Democrats feel about how this is going? And I'm looking at just the way the media has been covering this, and already it's kind of been backburnered. You know, this is the fourth time in history the President of the United States is facing impeachment. Obviously a big deal, but the major networks all did their programs with other stories last night. There was no impeachment story on New York Times A1. Oh, actually, this is the first edition of Thursday paper. No stories on impeachment. Fox and MSNBC have been carrying regular programming. It already feels, it feels like they've already lost the mojo on this. Do Democrats feel that way? Is that why they are so anxious just to get this thing done?
Well, I think it's what, Nancy Pelosi was talking about behind closed doors at first and then eventually to the press when she told her members, really, as soon as the Ukraine thing hit in late September, that she wanted to move expeditiously. I think she understood that it's hard to keep public attention. She lives in the era of Donald Trump where, where it's hard to stay on one topic from breakfast to lunch. And this has actually captured, you know, to some extent captured certainly the news media's attention for weeks and weeks and weeks in a way that nothing else has. The president has not been able to drive the story since the end of September. And he's starting to get a little bit of that back. He's starting to have the ability. This morning he attacked Time's Person of the Year, a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a moment.
And that certainly got people's attention. He's starting to get people's attention with his China trade talks, with the USMCA. So I think she understood that it was not going to hold forever. I think there will be some renewal around the Senate trial opening. It is sad that I think it's sad that there's a lack of focus on something that I think is serious and substantial. But I also understand that we live in a country where 26% of Americans can identify the three branches of government.
Yeah, only 26%. Yeah.
I didn't want to give an opinion on the percentage there. But
this. I mean, and overriding this, you mentioned this, is the short attention span. And I have tried to argue that I think that they are making a mistake by rushing through all this because at some point you need to let the public catch up. But things move so quickly. You know, who actually remembers Marie Yovanovitch's testimony right now? What exactly did William Taylor testify to? There were some dramatic moments, but it was like a fire hose. And rather than amplifying, look, I am among those. Who think that the evidence is very, very strong and justifies impeachment. But the argument is you also make the case to the public. And this sort of rushing ahead, it feels rushed and it frankly feels a little half-assed given the fact that they have not, you know, really worked to compel the testimony of certain key players and have not received a single document from the administration. So, and I understand the arguments. I've gotten a lot of blowback on this that would just take a long time. But it feels like that they sort of just want to, you know, check the box rather than make this thing happen?
I think that the demand for impeachment among the Democratic base was extremely strong from the get-go. When Republicans in the House charged that the Democrats were looking for a reason to impeach Donald Trump, that's absolutely true. That doesn't mean all the Democrats were doing that. Doesn't mean that Nancy Pelosi was doing that. Doesn't mean a majority of Democrats were willing to impeach him for no reason. But it does mean that there was that sentiment within the Democratic base that Donald Trump should be impeached for a whole lot of things going back to essentially the day he started in office. That being said, it doesn't mean that what he did with respect to the Ukraine does not represent a whole series of impeachable offenses. And it doesn't mean that that the obstruction of justice is meritless. And to your point, it doesn't mean that that there can't be, I think, reasonable debate about the extent to which you would let the court process play out before you decided this is, you know, too long or it's impossible to ever have any sort of process against a president because it takes too long to go through a court challenge. So just sort of all of that being said, I think that what the Democrats have not yet done after all this time is gotten to a place where they can explain this story in a fairly short set of fact and repeat it.
They have not. That it wasn't that the argument for going ahead with Ukraine was that it was easily explainable. I mean, that's what they were telling people. That's why they did this as opposed to the Mueller report, because it's very simple, one sentence explanation. President extorting an ally to dig up dirt on Joe Biden.
And you know, Charlie, I'm not a prosecutor, but I am somewhat familiar with the concept of prosecuting it's the type of case that the Democrats are looking at here. And what they're looking at here is like kind of your classic racketeering or continuing criminal enterprise case where you're making the argument that you've got the president sitting atop a large organization that's carrying out a criminal scheme. And in some, and you know, at some level, people within that organization understand instructions from the boss that are not necessarily given in, you know, the sort of go kill the guy way that you're going to get on a wiretap. And if you look at people who work for the president at the Justice Department and other places, including Rudy Giuliani, they have put away criminals on much less evidence in racketeering cases than there is against the president in the allegation of the quid pro quo here. So the question I have is, with all these Democrats who have worked as prosecutors before, and they don't have a ton of them, but they have a bunch of them, you know, why they haven't been able, because they thought this was the easily explainable case, why they haven't been able to do that. These folks have faced juries before. A jury of 12 average Americans shouldn't be that different than a jury of 330 million Americans. And so to me, it's either a failure of the case or a failure of communication.
Yeah, and I also think that what the Republicans have done, they don't have a substantive defense of Donald Trump. I think that's clear. They don't have a coherent substantive defense. So they've talked about process, but their main achievement and their goal has been is confusion and exhaustion. And whether you're talking about impeachment or whether you're talking about the IG report, I have to tell you, I do this for a living. You do this for a living. There's a point where you're listening to just the chaff that's being thrown up, and it is exhausting to sort through it all. All they needed to do was plant a certain amount of doubt, confuse people about what the content of the impeachment issues are, the content of the IG report, get people to turn off, you know, go back to their comfort zones, and that's a win for Republicans. And I'm reluctant to say this, but I feel that they've accomplished that mission.
And I do want to go back just for one second on the thing I said about the failure of the Democrats to either have the case or to make it. There is, and this goes to your point here, I mean, there is an asymmetry in the challenge, right?
Yes, very much so.
For the Republicans, they just have to convince, for the most part, just have to convince the people who agree with them or who are inclined to agree with them that there's some doubt. And people have very strong passions. There's not, in terms of voting, there's not a whole lot of people walking, if you were to compare this to a trial, not a whole lot of people walking into that jury box with no preconceived notions about Donald Trump. You know, and so there are, you know, 62 million Americans, 63 million Americans who voted for him, plus whatever percentage, you know, that suggests agree with him beyond that, that didn't vote. And so you look at that and you go, okay, the challenge is smaller for Republicans to just kind of throw some dirt up in the air and say, this isn't a problem. If you like our president, you can stick with him. The challenge for Democrats is bigger. And at some level, going back to the thought that Pelosi and the Democrats were waiting for their moment, or the base was kind of waiting for its moment, she guided them at the very least to a place where they weren't going to injure themselves by impeaching him. I mean, I know that sounds
right. Do no harm.
You laughed,
yeah.
But
I agree with you.
I mean, you know, you saw the vote to move forward on impeachment on the House floor, and they only lost two Democrats. I think if they'd had that vote, you know, 2 months earlier, or 3 months earlier, they might not have been able to pass it. If they had passed it, they would have twisted a lot of arms. They might have lost a lot of seats over it in the next election. I think they got to a place where they were pretty comfortable actually having the vote, and pretty comfortable that they wouldn't lose the House over it. So, you know, it's tough politics.
It is tough politics. Okay, speaking of politics, I want to talk about the presidential race and some of the other developments in the last couple of days, including polls, as well as, and let's talk about the president deciding this morning that he was going to tweet out an attack on a 16-year-old girl. But before we do that, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple. Starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, we are back with Jonathan Allen from NBC. So Time Magazine choosing Greta Thunberg as their person of the year. This means that they had to pass over the pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong, the U.S. whistleblower, Nancy Pelosi, and the President of the United States, and they chose a 16-year-old girl, which, by the way, I mean, I just leave that aside. I have some problems with that. But the President of the United States, of course, has to weigh in on this, right? Because Donald Trump always has to weigh in on everything. And he lashes out at this young girl who has Asperger's, saying that she needs to deal with her anger issues. What do you say, John?
Well, there's some folks who suggest that the president projects a little bit.
You think?
I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so I wouldn't get into that kind of analysis. But I know there are many people who believe the president projects a little bit. So, you know, dealing with the anger issues.
Lots of people are saying that.
Lots of people may be wondering about that. And obviously Time has chosen as its person of the year a few people who I think anybody in the United States in at this time would find despicable and deplorable. So you can't necessarily judge that the president didn't win because Time magazine finds him to be too good of a person or bad of a person or anything like that.
Hitler has been the man of the year, right? I mean, Hitler was at least once or twice.
1938. It's not necessarily a values proposition about whether the person is good or bad who won, or that the person that comes in. Whoever came in second in 1938, I guarantee you, 100% chance is a better human being than Adolf Hitler was a better human being. It is a peculiar need to lash out at a child who has spoken about her diagnosis with a difficulty with a challenge.
She said it's Asperger's.
And to mock her for it in a way that
mutism
tugs at it specifically. Go see a movie with your friends and chill out. I mean, it's just there was a time. People get mad at me when I say there was a time on Twitter. I do that sometimes, and they get very angry. But I would say there was a time when it was not considered manly to attack children, to attack girls. And it makes the president feel like more of a man to do that.
That's an
unusual thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, does it make us old-fashioned that we think that, hey, this is just inappropriate behavior, that a grown man, the most powerful man in the world, should not be mocking a teenager who has significant mental health challenges, for whatever reason? It's just wrong to do that.
I mean,
are we now the outliers?
I mean, frankly, it's inappropriate behavior no matter whom you aim it at. Especially if you're the president of the United States, because there's a power differential between you and everybody else. And then if you go beyond that to her age, if you go beyond it to gender, if you go beyond it to the specific thing that he was mocking her about, that is a challenge for her. I mean, the list goes on and on. And a week after the president and his team were objecting to to some criticism to me, I said rightly so, were objecting to the invocation of his son at a congressional hearing.
Oh yeah, remember all of the faux outrage about that the president can name his son Barron, but he can't make him a Barron. I mean, sort of a lame play on words. And that was, Trump world was aflame with indignation.
Without getting too much into opinion, we are all better off when kids are left out of the public debate as political pawns either way, as objects of derision. I think the reason that the professor came back and apologized, she realized there was no need. She could make the same point without bringing a kid into it. It's not as big as it got blown up into, but. It's amazing to me that a week later, it's not amazing. We've been living with this.
Yeah, I know. We're
discussion
we're no
for so many years, but not a week later. Here we go, and the president is attacking a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Girl.
So here I am this morning, and this is what sort of the headbanging moment, because I really do question Time Magazine's choice of the 16-year-old girl for exactly the reason you mentioned. I mean, she's a child. There are substantive people out there who I think would have been better choices, as opposed to sort of the making of the child icon, the child prophet. But, once Trump enters, into it, then, of course, the lines are drawn. So our ability to hold these two ideas in our heads at the same time is going to be, tested again. Because I think, and I'm just going to get killed on this on social media. You don't know what that's like. But I mean, I just this is going to be bad. That it's possible to regard Trump's attack on Thunberg as really crass and tasteless, but also regarding her choice as absurd. Because, quite frankly, in making children political icons infantilizes our politics. And we know how this works, unfortunately. There's a lot of cynical opportunism in setting up the child as somehow this prophet of moral clarity. When in fact what they are is they're front people for adults with political agendas. And it does feel exploitative. I mean, to use them as kind of human shields. And with Greta Thunberg, this is what makes it so difficult. She's such an admirable young girl, but she's also a deeply troubled one. So I think she needs tremendous respect and compassion. but thrusting her into this vortex of politics and controversy and media, you know, is not necessarily the best possible choice. And unfortunately, she's going to be used by both sides. And that seems unfair to a 16-year-old girl who, you know, frankly, you know, ought to be allowed to be a 16-year-old girl. And I know I'm going to get thoroughly dragged for this.
Well, let me address two pieces of that. I think you can both object to the, you know, canonization, lionization, the pick of Time's Person of the Year. You can say you don't agree with that pick, and you don't have to attack some, you know. I mean, you are doing right now, you're not attacking her. You're not attacking her personally. You know, I think that you can, I think there's a space there where you can say this isn't the right choice for Time's Person of the Year. You don't believe it's the right choice. And also, it's wrong to attack her and to attack her on this mental health challenge she's got.
In this way, yeah.
The other thing I would say is the reason that children are used, and in some cases, especially when you're dealing with adolescents, it may well be because they personally care about the issue. I mean, you know, it may not be that they're entirely, you know, put up to it, an issue she cares about, an issue other kids care about. Certainly the Parkland kids, they were, you know, victims of violence in their school. But the reason that they become part of the public discussion and capture the public imagination, and we see this on a variety of issues, whether you're talking about the fight over abortion, whether you're talking about gun violence, other issues, the reason is that they are so effective at capturing our attention and pulling at our heartstrings. You know, I think the sort of public perception of the civil rights movement changed significantly when you saw, I mean, I wasn't alive at the time, but when white people in other parts of the country saw white authorities turning hoses and dogs on black children in Alabama, you know, there was a strategic decision to you know, put children out in the streets and to make them part of the protest, part of the demonstration, to make them vulnerable to that kind of abuse. And it was very effective.
It was effective. And I think...
And by the way, they were vulnerable to that abuse, sure, just not on camera before.
Right. So, but this also can be cynical opportunism. And one of the reasons, of course, that the, you know, child icon, child prophet is so useful is it's also a way of shutting down criticism because, you know, their moral clarity means how dare you criticize them? How dare you do that? And you know, so that you have things that even when they say things that are silly or advance unrealistic policies, we're supposed to react emotionally rather than rationally. So this is what I mean by it infantilizes. Look, when I tweeted out something about this, people said, well, does this mean you don't care about climate change or that climate change isn't real? And my response is, well, no. There are people who are actually doing substantive work on this. There are many world-class climate scientists who, if you want to call attention to it, but this was about celebrity, not about substance.
Well, so. You know, but then again, you know, Time's Person of the Year in, I'm probably going to get the year wrong, but I think it was 1960, was The Scientist, and we all know that's been very ineffective over time.
Yeah, well,
science seems to be going out the window, Charlie.
science is
I'm just kidding. I love science.
No, of course we do. Okay, so moving on here. What do you make of the Politico report that Joe Biden has been telling people that he only intended to serve one term?
I believe rumors of Joe Biden's conversations with people get around pretty easily, and there are a lot of things that get said, and I don't, I wouldn't take that seriously until it was on paper from his campaign in a press release and repeated by the candidate at a microphone and then seconded by somebody else on camera.
And, and they're denying it. But that's a double-edged sword, because if he was elected, he would be 82 at the end of his first term. He's old now. That's a lot older. And
it's
so
young for the Bible, Charlie.
Yes.
Methuselah was like 960 years old.
He should try that. I'm not old. I am biblical. I am biblical in my years and my age. But it cuts both ways, because number one, it would basically say, look, I'm just kind of the I'm the firebreak here. You know, put me in there. We'll get rid of Trump. We'll move on. But it's not a permanent investment. The downside, of course, it makes him a lame duck, but puts tremendous pressure then on the vice presidential nominee, who basically you're electing from the Democratic point of view. You're picking two presidents if you do that, because whoever is picked becomes immediately the heir apparent. So that would certainly raise the stakes there, but
I mean,
might
a Democratic vice president hasn't become president of the United States since Lyndon Johnson, right? I mean, when was the last? You just said that, I hadn't thought about it.
Yeah,
in a while,
no. That's, I love that.
When was the last time a Democratic vice president was elected without, you know, in their own right, without the president having died before them? I mean, you know, because Roosevelt died before Truman became president. I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't work that way on the Democratic side as much as one might want it to if they were a Democratic president.
didn't work for Hubert Humphrey. Didn't work for Walter Mondale. No,
didn't work for Al Gore.
You know, but these things are broken. I remember having lots of shows where I talked about, you know, back in 2008, you know, people from the Senate almost never get elected president. I mean, the last time anybody elected president from the Senate was, any of that stuff.
Or like Pete Buttigieg says, the last three Democratic presidents, he's got a line right now, but the last three Democratic presidents were new to the scene, hadn't run for president before. But he's also forgetting the ones that hadn't run before that lost, like John Kerry and Mike Dukakis. I mean, he's not forgetting them. He's just conveniently not telling that part of the story.
Okay, so Pete Buttigieg. It is amazing to me, watching from the outside, you know, watching progressive Democrats decide that Pete must be killed. I mean, open up Twitter.
I don't think
today.
They want to go that far, Charlie.
No. But
the campaign, I think, is what they want to do.
Okay. Hashtag refund Pete, which is, I guess they're all tweeting. You sort of have the Warren folks and the Bernie bros all ganging up on him. Let me just read one of the tweets that seems to have started this off. After corrupt Democratic candidate Pete Buttigieg attended a private Wall Street fundraiser in New York City, many people are now demanding a refund for their donations. Ask for a refund by emailing your receipt to. So Pete goes to this Wall Street fundraiser in New York City, which I didn't know that was like now completely toxic. And
you're only allowed to raise money from places you can't raise money from.
So that seems there does to be sort of a saint off between him and Elizabeth Warren, where they're debating levels of purity that are just kind of head scratching. I mean, what did we spend a whole week talking about? Well, you know, who did he consult for when he worked for McKinsey?
Well, I mean, he's from South Bend, so I suppose he wins a saint off. That's my his father was a professor at Notre Dame. I mean, you can't get more saintly than that in the United States, right?
But there's a level of purity here that you know, how much money did Elizabeth Warren make over a 20-year period by representing corporate? I mean, have we gotten to the point where just the term corporate money is just like is itself like toxic? I mean, is it that, were we at that point?
There is a strangeness to the saint off on the Democratic side, given that the president of the United States essentially admitted to tax fraud with his charity.
Yes. Speaking of symmetry.
Everyone seems to miss this, I guess, this settlement in New York for like, what, $2 million within the last couple of weeks where the president's charity was, not a charity.
Okay, thank you. This is important.
This is a problem.
Though the larger problem is major things happen, and it's like, well, yeah, same old, same old. No, wait, but let's just slow everything down. The president just paid $2 million to deal with the fact that his charity was so fraudulent, and he and members of his family are now banned from being involved in charity. That's, you can imagine on Earth 3.0.
You're not allowed to do kindnesses anymore. You're not allowed to be involved in charities without supervision. I mean, that sounds like you're on a list somewhere. I mean,
if there was any other human being on Earth, that would be like a career-ending thing, right? I mean, it's like putting this scarlet, you know, thing on your face, and yet it's Trump, and it's like, yeah, whatever. So I mean, yeah, pay off porn stars, yeah, shake down foreign governments. It's like whatever, but
there's an
asymmetry. Pete Buttigieg tried to raise money for the Salvation Army. Oh my God, cancel it.
Charlie, yesterday he was at a fundraiser and he talked about zero-based budgeting, and I thought to myself, Charlie Sykes is—he's gonna like write a check or something. I mean, not that you would write a check to him, but zero-based, I was no. like, Charlie's gonna be pretty excited when he hears about this, right?
Well, I'm not appalled by it. It's just it is something that's going on. You know, our friend Tim Miller, who's a contributor to the Bulwark, does have an interesting piece. He's been writing a lot about Tim. I mean, sorry, writing a lot about Mayor Pete. And he says, you know, look, Democrats all claim that Trump's this unique existential danger and threat to democracy, but they're not acting like it. Because if they were acting like it, they wouldn't be eating their own with such incredible relish. I mean, they wouldn't be devoting so much of their attention. There's a little bit of me that's kind of a flashback to 2015, 2016, when Trump was running and all the Republicans figured, hey, we don't need to worry about Trump. Let's attack one another. Let's spend hundreds of millions. You know, Jeb! Exclamation point is going to spend millions of dollars ripping down Marco Rubio, and then Marco Rubio will attack Ted Cruz and everything. Because don't worry, we don't need to actually attack Donald Trump. It's almost like the Democrats are in some ways, in a kind of a bizarro way, you know, let's take out anybody that's not a socialist, or let's take out whatever. You know what I'm getting at?
I do. You know, what's interesting to me is, and Buttigieg has done, sort of the direct version of this, the comparison to Obama, but over time he sounds more and more like Obama in that David Axelrod communications kind of way. And what I mean by that is, like, on every issue, it's sort of like, we don't need to go too far left, and we don't need to go too far right. He takes two things and rejects both of them to land himself kind of in the center where he wants to be. And what I, over time, basically his campaign has been populated by all the people that worked with David Axelrod. And so there's this real, like, sort of regeneration of an Obama feel to the Buttigieg campaign, minus all of the people of color supporting the Obama campaign.
But wait. I thought Deval Patrick was the Obama candidate. Did you remember he's still in the race?
Who?
I had to remind myself of that.
Who? Oh, yeah, Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts. I remember him. Yeah, no. Yeah. Do you remember there was an event that he did outside the last Democratic debate, and there were no people in the chairs?
Yeah, we know how that started, how that worked for Mark Sanford.
It was like a Cleveland Indians game circa, now Jim's mad at me, like a Cleveland Indians game circa 1988.
Okay, so Michael Bloomberg, and these numbers are just staggering. The millions of dollars he's spending, and people are, and I don't think that this is trolling. People are, you know, as a parlor game, thinking what else you could have done with all of this. I mean, he's getting to the point where he could have bought the Washington Post with the amount of money that he's already blown on television ads to get him to what? What's 5% of the vote? What is your take on the Bloomberg campaign?
So much money to be had if you're a consultant.
Oh, yeah. We picked the wrong profession, man.
I think that if you're Mike Bloomberg, there is a really, really good opportunity to get yourself a seat at the table at the Democratic convention. Right? You're looking around, yeah. And you're like, look, there's four candidates that you don't see going anywhere, all of whom are going to win delegates. There's a reasonably good chance none of them is going to get, you know, a majority of the delegates by the time you get to a convention. Why not pick off some delegates yourself, get yourself a seat at the table, see if you could do some negotiations, see if you can use that opportunity to force some stuff on the platform. I don't think Bloomberg sees himself as likely to to win 50% of the delegates heading into a convention. It's hard to imagine that. Mm. Then again, with all that money, it's very difficult for other people to play in all the Super Tuesday states simultaneously. You know, we were just talking about Buttigieg. His favorability ratings are at a place where nationally, where you can see that, like, you know, 30% of the people don't know who he is when you give them his name. Which suggests to me there's an even larger group, you know, that's kind of pretending to know who he is. So you're Bloomberg, you know, like, you get to run ads in California and Texas and whatnot at, you know, 5 times the level, 10 times the level of a guy like that. Maybe you can pick off, 10%, 12%, 15%, something like that. Probably need at least 15% in most of the places because that's the delegate threshold level. But I don't know. If you're willing to spend $1 billion of your $50 billion-plus dollars, why not?
Well, also, if you're willing to spend $1 billion, the $100 million is only a portion of that. It's like you can still spend 10 times as much, which made it interesting. I thought that he announced that he was going to spend $10 million to back up the vulnerable Democrats on the issue of who might be faced with problems with the impeachment vote, which I'm guessing he was getting a lot of, you know, calls saying, hey, if you're going to spend that kind of money, you could actually have a real effect in some of these swing congressional districts, not to mention the battleground states. I mean,
amazing to me is that the Democrats didn't 3 months ago or 4 months ago start running ads, Super PAC ads, Mike Bloomberg ads, George Soros ads, whatever conspiracy theory set you want throw at it, ads laying out the impeachment case. Like, if the shoe was on the other foot and you had Republicans running an impeachment against a Democratic president, you can bet that the airwaves would have been full of the three-step case.
Well, Tom
for why
Steyer,
the president had,
Tom
you know,
Steyer was doing that. He was running those impeachment ads when there wasn't really any grounds for impeachment at this point, and then decided to spend the money on himself. So among the Democrats, they do have this weird problem right now with, you know, Kamala Harris dropping out, and possibility of Cory Booker not making the debate stage, that you're going to have more billionaires than members of minority groups. It, you know, this is what makes politics so interesting. You know, if you go back 6 months ago and you and I were having this conversation, think about the powerhouse candidates that were in this race. Kamala Harris, a successful popular senator from the biggest state in the country, California. You know, Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, who had also, you know, done very, very well. The hottest rock star candidate from Texas, Beto O'Rourke. And as of right now, they're all gone. And a 37-year-old mayor from South Bend, Indiana is in the top-tier candidate. So, I mean, it's like, wow. You can't call the shot all the time, can you?
No, absolutely not. No, it's difficult to call shots. I mean, you know, the sort of amazing thing, we're looking at a Democratic debate stage, likely at this next debate where you are, I guess Yang has made the debate, right, with the last poll. So it's not going to be an all-white Democratic debate stage. But if you think back to the Republican debates the last time around, and of course they didn't have this sort of survivor aspect to them with the way that they were run. But, you know, you had Marco Rubio and Ben Carson. You had Carly Fiorina. You know, you had some diversity in and gender diversity and racial diversity and ethnic diversity on the Republican side, which is not as reflective of the Republican electorate. Whereas on the Democratic side now, you're getting a lot less reflective of the Democratic electorate as time goes on with the candidates they have on stage, even though there are still a number of candidates in the race. And that is going to be a discussion that I think is going to become increasingly pitched in the Democratic primary debate. I don't know what effect it has, but I think you're going to hear a lot about it, especially if the four leading candidates going through Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states, which are, I think, both 91% or so white, if the first four ranking candidates through in both of those states are white candidates, I can't imagine that that's not going to be something that you're hearing a lot about.
It is worth remembering, though, that this process, as annoying as it is, is very effective at sifting and winnowing. You do find out who the good candidates are. And, you know, I was listening to a commentary on a certain cable network yesterday. We're talking about how they just couldn't understand how somebody with such a great candidate as Harris had not made it. You know, she had everything. And I'm, of course, yelling back at the radio. I was listening on Sirius XM, thinking, well, because she really wasn't that good a candidate. She wasn't that good a presidential candidate. And there is a huge disconnect between being a successful state-level candidate and then moving on to that big stage. And there's a reason why the candidates who have dropped out. And I mean, it's relatively simple that they were not able to establish their brand, their name, and many of them made significant mistakes.
Yeah, I mean the merit matters in terms of trying to win over. I mean, you've got a certain goal, and that's to win over voters. You know, in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and nationally, and sort of do those things at the same time, so that you're and win over donors, and so everybody kind of knows what the game is, and you set your strategy and you try to do it, and you know. Some were able to do it and some were not able to do it. And if the field, you know, if the map was set differently, maybe different things would happen, but it is set the way that it is. And, you know, I think that Harris's biggest problem, my personal belief is her biggest problem, was she didn't decide whether she wanted to be a candidate of the left, a candidate of the center. She wavered back and forth between those things and got threshed in the middle. And, you know, going back and forth. And you can't do that, especially in modern politics. The old rules of politics, where you try to not be anything to anyone, is and end up being everything to everyone, or vice versa, it doesn't work anymore.
Unless you are just super established, like
Joe Biden.
So you and I are missing this, unfortunately, because we're having this conversation. But in the category of irony being dead, and this is part of the problem, I think, of keeping your head about you in this particular age, is there are things that are happening. You go, it's going to make my head explode. So Matt Gaetz apparently spent 5 minutes going off on Hunter Biden's substance abuse problems. Matt Gaetz, who has how many drunk driving arrests, without any sort of sense of sort of personal self-shame. And apparently, so one of the other Democratic congressmen, Hank Johnson, looks toward him and says, you know, something about the pot calling the kettle black. It's like, you know, is there anybody, you know, like adults in the room, who would say to Matt Gaetz, okay, if we're going to go after Hunter Biden's substance abuse problems, maybe, Matt, you should sit this one out. But no.
But here's the sad thing. They all know, again, we talk about the asymmetry again. Matt Gaetz knows that going after Hunter Biden and causing pain for Joe Biden is going to win him favor with Republicans, whether or not it blows up Matt Gaetz personally or not, and that blowing up Matt Gaetz is a small thing compared to trying to blow up the rival to Donald Trump. The incentive structures are, you know, nobody cares about their personal reputation anymore.
You're right.
Some of the things these guys are saying, it's beyond me that, you know, some of the stuff that Congressman Jordan from Ohio has been saying during this hearing, that that if the Democrats on the other side decided they wanted to respond to him about investigations, would open him up for. But there's a lot of shamelessness.
There is a lot of shamelessness, and maybe that's the rubric of our politics. And this is we've talked about this many times. This is Donald Trump's superpower, his absolute shamelessness. And the extraordinary thing is the way that has been communicated to many of his supporters. It's like, see, what an entire political party that has basically adopted shamelessness as one of its modes of operation.
And by the way, Mr. Gaetz went to school at Florida State University. I don't know when he got those citations or whatever, but it's usually easy to find a party bus or somebody else to drive for you at Florida State.
Is it really? Okay.
Just for what it's worth. I did not go there, but I had some friends that did, and it should not be hard to find a ride there.
Yeah, I think that would be true at the University of Wisconsin as well. Jonathan Allen, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our episode was brought to you by Quip. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.